call someone who cares. Yeah, here's a quarter, call someone who cares. Yeah, yeah.
Well, this morning on Life Matters, a discussion about what has to happen to make all Australian workplaces actually look like multicultural Australia. CEOs of Australian companies are more likely to be called Peter than be a woman, let alone a non-Anglo woman, or indeed an Asian man. For instance, about 10% or so of the Australian community has an Asian background, but only 1.9% of executive managers and 4% of directors have Asian cultural origins. Our parliaments are dominated by Anglo men and women, and so are our annual honours lists. An audit of the 800-odd recipients of Queen's Birthday Honours in 2014 found there were only about 25 names suggesting a non-European background. In other power centres, of the 81 departmental secretaries and deputy secretaries in Canberra, less than 5% came from non-European backgrounds. And the mainstream media is no different. Stephanie Fu is a Malaysian Chinese American. Look, it's hard to imagine you could claim to be Chinese in this world and a minority. I mean, really. But Stephanie found herself among a sea of white faces when she joined National Public Radio in the US. That's their public broadcaster. But hang on, I asked her. Don't the Americans do better with diversity in the media than we do in Australia?
In many forms of media, maybe, but in public radio, we're sorely behind.
And when you talk public radio, you mean like the ABC in Australia, the BBC in the UK?
Exactly. Sort of NPR and NPR-style programming. Unfortunately, my peers don't listen to public radio. And in fact, I never listened to it. In fact, I don't listen to it now. I don't own a radio. And the problem there is that there aren't voices like mine on the radio. There's just a vast lack of diversity. There are no people of color or a very small amount of people of color. And there's a lack of young people on the air. And the consequence is you're not going to reach those audiences if you're not going to have people who are there's three real issues. First of all, the hosts and reporters. Mm-hmm. Second, the kinds of stories we tell. And third, the way that we tell those stories are all in a sort of older, whiter style and sphere. You know, public radio should be public. It should be catering to our entire nation. Minorities in America will outnumber whites in just one generation. And yet we are only catering to a 65-plus white audience.
So you mean to tell me that you now work in public radio, but you didn't grow up listening to public radio? When did you discover it?
When I was 20, I was in the car and my friend wanted to play This American Life on her podcast.
Now, this is a very well-known podcast, listened to around the world.
Yes, and I had never heard of it. I begged her not to play it. I was like, I really don't like talk radio. I don't understand why we can't just listen to La Tigra and sing in the car and dance. And she was like, no, you're going to like this, trust me. And she played it, and after that, I was completely hooked.
And what did you like?
The voices were more like mine. They weren't performative, and they were vulnerable. They didn't necessarily seem like experts, and they weren't condescending to me. They were like me.
And you would expect that. I mean, This American Life is a podcast which features stories from ordinary Americans organised around a theme. And Ira Glass, who's wonderful, and I'm a fan, does seem to think that he has reinvented broadcasting, which is very touching. But how well do they actually deal with diversity in the workplace as well as on air?
I can't speak for This American Life historically, you know, they have had a ton of white and Jewish producers. But in the time that I've been there, my workplace has been pretty tremendously diverse. I am Malaysian, Chinese, American. Miki Meek is Japanese American. We have two Latino producers right now, two black producers. And it feels like a really safe space to work. It feels like we do really diverse stories and that everyone's voices are equal and everyone's voices are heard.
What stories would you do differently than would a fleet of white and Jewish producers?
Well, I would speak specifically for maybe Robin Semyon, one of our black producers. who has done a couple of stories about race. One of them was with W. Kamau Bell, and it was about teaching your children about racism. At what point do you teach them that, you know, they will face injustices in America? And as a mother, as a Black mother with Black children or mixed race children, I think that she tackled that subject with more sensitivity and nuance and empathy and humor as well than necessarily a white producer trying to do the same thing would have.
And so does the production team drive the push for diversity there because they think it's the right thing to do, or because they think our audience is really white and they're getting older and they may die and we may need a new one?
No. I think that a lot of us are young, first of all. And I think that Ira prioritizes hiring young people around him so that the show always sounds adventurous and new, and he lets us take risks, which is really great. But for me personally, I have never done a story where I've chosen to do it because this would be good for diversity. I've never gone out and searched for stories saying, I'm going to find Chinese stories, or I'm going to find...
Chinese reporter.
Yeah, I'm the Chinese.
I'll do the Chinese story.
Absolutely not. No, and I've done 200 stories at this point. I don't know that they're necessarily skewed to any one race, but the fact of the matter is I'm going to find more diverse stories because I just do stories that I think are interesting and that I care about and that... And I think that as a young Asian American, I'm exposed to, through my friends, through Facebook, through going out and drinking at bars, a more diverse stories than necessarily a 50-year-old white man would be.
So what's the benefit of hiring you? I'm just being really hard-assed here. What's the benefit of hiring you? Because you do better stories? Because you do different stories? Or because you're going to deliver me a better audience, a bigger audience, a more diverse audience?
Not better. I don't think better is the right word. But I do stories differently. You know, when I started a podcast when I was 24, I did a music podcast called Stage Dive. And my audience, my demographics were mostly 14 to 24-year-olds. In public radio, that is the most desired demographic of people.
Radio managers in Australia would be desperate to get their hands on that audience.
Desperate. And I did not get that audience because I sought out saying, I'm going to find that audience. I'm going to find 14 to 24-year-olds. No, I found that audience because at the time I was 24 years old. I was a 24-year-old woman and I did stuff. I did content that interested me and in a way that was interesting to me. That it was very heavy on the sound design. There was a lot of rock and dubstep and there were sound effects and it was really elaborately scored and I interviewed young rock stars and, you know, got them to tell me jokes and had like exclusive content from them and people loved it. And for me, I think that most of my fans tend to be on the younger side. Because I do good work that represents them.
Fatima Meesham, a columnist and consulting editor at Eureka Street, a public affairs journal here in Australia, is listening to us. Stephanie, Fatima, good morning to you.
Hello, good morning.
Is this ringing a bell?
Yes, absolutely. I'm not in that domain. I'm not in radio or podcasting, but I do write commentary. And, you know, you just open any masthead in Australia, and you typically it'll be a white, middle-aged, well-educated man commenting on policy issues, you know. And so clearly, we have this narrowing of what's considered legitimate and valid perspectives, you know.
Or the voice of authority. Whose voice has authority?
Exactly. So, you know, what's regarded as conventional wisdom is actually wisdom of white, male, educated men. And we lose out on that. We lose out on nuance and complexity, and we lose out on a richer understanding of some of the really complicated issues that we face today.
Fatima, sometimes you get caught up in these great sweeps where people say, right, we're going to be more diverse. Find me
Absolutely.
Some females. Find me some non-Anglo females. Go on, beat the bushes and find some.
And that's frustrating. That's frustrating because it's really superficial ticking boxes. And sometimes, you know, you see that on a panel where there's the token brown person or person of color. And organizations pat themselves on the back for having, you know, accomplished that, or they're progressive because they have this brown person on the panel. And to me, it's so superficial. It doesn't really address the structural nature of the problem.
When you look at television in Australia, the ABC, I mean, leave SBS out of it maybe for a moment, but commercial TV... Do you ever see yourself?
No, quite rarely. And it's usually, I mean, you know, the only reason that a person of colour might turn up would be on a current affair show where we're apparently doing bad things. Or, you know, there's always a sense of the negative stories tend to really reflect, you know, people of colour. So it's quite rare that you would find a person of colour just actually being themselves. So whether it's in soap operas or particularly soap operas or current affair shows and other types of programs, the presence of a person of colour is there for a particular reason. They're never really just being completely themselves. They're there to serve some kind of purpose.
So diagnose it for me. Why is a white male or a white woman with a journalism degree and maybe great marks from a journalism degree, Fatima, going to be an easier hire than someone who looks and sounds like you?
A lot of that is because, I suppose there are historical reasons for that. Like for the past couple decades or so, the people who have floated to the top in terms of providing commentary do tend to be a particular type. And so they build a profile, they have name recognition. And so for editors and producers who are sometimes under pressure to drive traffic or to get the audience in, they would naturally get someone who will bring a captive audience. So there's a kind of risk aversion to getting someone like me to comment.
Stephanie, I want to put that to you. I got this job a couple of weeks ago. I'm a middle-aged woman and people keep saying, stop saying you're middle-aged. Well, unless I'm going to live to 120, this is the middle. I think I got this job because I can do it without any training. So that's one part of it. And also, it's not going to reflect, no one's taking a risk here with me. So if you're a manager, it's not going to blow up in their face.
And, you know, I think you're a terrific interviewer, first of all. Second of all, happy to see a woman host. There's not enough of that. So, you know, congratulations. Mm. On the other hand, without risk, you're not going to have growth. Without taking risks, you're saying there's no space for you to change and develop over the years. And if you're not going to change and develop, then how is your audience going to develop along with you? How are you going to get to different people who are changing?
Well, and also, don't you need to overlook me? Once in a while, you're going to need to say, you know, there's a job. 9 a.m. Radio National, we're not going to give it to the white chick.
I think that's true. I think that if you want to expand your army of hosts and producers, then sometimes you are going to have to overlook white candidates for talented and qualified people of color. And maybe that will need, maybe these people of color may need more training.
And
maybe.
So when you're talking as if there's a ready pool out there of talented and trained people of color, ready to go, being overlooked.
Well, first of all,
doesn't an organisation like this and like yours need to ensure that that pool exists?
There's evidence that journalists, black journalists and Asian journalists are hired out of journalism school far less frequently than white journalists who do graduate from those jobs. So, A, I think that they are there. Maybe they haven't been given the same opportunities. Maybe they haven't been able to take the same internships as their perhaps richer white counterparts have been able to, because, first of all, we do not really pay interns in this industry. That is pretty much acknowledged worldwide. And
so
I had
to
serve
a student who needs to get paid when they're doing work because you don't have a trust fund or you just don't have middle class parents, then right there you're behind the eight ball.
You know, in order to take my first public radio internship, I had to, you know, live in complete squalor and eat ramen noodles for a year to save enough money to take an internship, which is crazy. And if you don't really care about public radio that much, and why should you if you're not being represented in it, then why would you do that? I think that if you want to have that talent pool, you're going to have to actively recruit it and to actively educate it.
Fatima, are there people in Australia who don't look like me, who are maybe, I don't know, 30 to 50, who have been overlooked for jobs, who are out there going, well, I'm just bitter and twisted, I'm done. I can't get a job.
I imagine so. You know, I think as Stephanie was saying, you know, basically what Stephanie is saying is merit is the baseline. It's not like people of color are not asking for a free pass. And actually they are not invisible, you know, so I think there are other factors that there are other factors that explain why it is majority white on our opinion pages and on our TV programs.
What about this, Fatima? What about if my parents have come from China, my parents have come from India, we live in Western Sydney, we live in Western Melbourne, and they have worked too darn hard for me to have some silly career in the media, thank you very much. They want me to go to uni, they want me to be an accountant, they want me to be a lawyer, they want me to be a doctor. This is what they need me to do.
Yeah, and I understand that. Actually, that's a really good point because there are especially the creative industries. It's difficult sometimes for people to make a living in the creative industries, and certainly that poses certain really hard questions about, like, for producers and editors in terms of how far they're willing to go in terms of reducing barriers to entry, because I remember speaking to Tim Sitpalmasan for that article for the Realtor Center. He's a racial discrimination commissioner. He pointed out that, especially in commentary, those people who are able to withstand not earning much from commentary have these other jobs. You know, so it's almost like a hobby for them, or at least, you know, if they build a profile, then they're already earning from that profile. But for people like me and other people, you know, it's at the end of the day, it does come down to material reasons. And I think it goes down to things like actually paying interns and actually offering paid fellowships. And you know, that's part of the whole reducing barriers to entry, because they are there. And it's not that there aren't talented, you know, eager, driven young people of colour out there. It's just there are barriers to entry that need to be addressed.
You're listening to Life Matters. This is Ellen Fanning with you, and we're talking about what to do if your workplace is too white. Why don't the people who hold the powerful roles in Australia, in politics, our universities, and much of our media, reflect the multicultural reality of Australia? Let's go back to my chat with American radio producer Stephanie Fu and Fatima Meacham, contributing editor with Eureka Street. I asked Stephanie, if you do hire a person of colour, how do you make sure they don't end up leaving because they are still very much in the minority, a token whose views are shouted down by the dominant culture?
I think that's really difficult. And I think lots of people in public radio, people of colour in public radio in America, leave just for that reason, and not necessarily because we're quietly spoken. But if you are the only person of color in a room and you say, oh, you know what, I really think that might be offensive, and everybody turns on you and says, you're being overly sensitive, we're not racist, we were the best at our jobs, you're new here, you shut up, you talk like we talk, and you, you know, conform now, then eventually you're going to feel bullied into, next time you hear something offensive, you know what, maybe you'll keep quiet. Maybe you just won't even speak up. I've heard that story like dozens of times.
So what comes first? Do you transform a workplace? Or do you build a talent pool? Do you go out to the journalism schools or wherever else you can think of to find creative people? Or do you just say, every time we hire here, if we're going to hire 10 people, at least 5 of them have to be women, and at least half of them have to look like Australia. We cannot keep hiring Anglo men and women. And so each time we hire, we have to make that decision, each and every time.
I think that you do it simultaneously. Simultaneously, yes. I think that you say, you know what, in all of our new hires, we are going to, again, represent Australia as it is. And immediately, you want to be able to make any of those hires comfortable. So you should be educating your office and making sure that everybody knows how to be supportive in the workplace and how to sometimes, and this is hard with people who talk for a living, shut up and listen.
I've just sat well back from the microphone when you said it. Fatima, do you think it would make a difference if the ABC and SBS merged?
Oh, that's a bit of a, a curveball.
Yeah, I know. What do you think?
I haven't actually thought about it, to be honest. I suppose there is merit to it in terms of actually immediately diversifying the talent pool. But, you know, I think it comes down to the sincerity. It comes down to how sincere people who have power actually are in diversifying the workplace and the stories that they produce. So if you're going to bring people of color in, you have to be prepared to actually listen to, as Stephanie was saying, listen to the perspectives that they will bring instead of shoehorning them into certain narratives. Because then really, that's another assertion of power. You know, now we've let you in and we're only going to let you cover particular stories from particular angles. And to me, that's insincere. And really, in a way, you might end up doing more damage than not hiring at all. So if you're going to hire, be sincere about it. And I think, I suppose it goes down to cultural change, really. And I think safety is a big part of that, which is what Stephanie has been saying. You know, safety ensures that people will be willing to join your workplace and are willing to stay there, and that you will get the best out of them rather than them feeling as if they have to be a spokesperson all the time. I mean, I remember, I think BuzzFeed, for one, has actually been actively looking at the diversity of their workforce, and their working definition of diversity is to actually have enough people, not just one or two or here and there, enough people across their division so no one particular person has to feel like they have to carry the viewpoint of their entire, you know, of their entire group, whatever that happens to be. And I think, to me, that that's a worthwhile goal. And I'm just thinking about what happened with Paul Sheehan, for example, where he wrote an article that was so journalistically didn't stand up, but then also cast young Muslim men in a very negative light. And I saw that come out, and I thought, gee, what if they had enough Muslims in the newsroom or in the editorial room to go, you know what, this doesn't smell right. You know,
You're talking about the Sydney Morning Herald.
That's right.
Columnist Paul Sheehan, and of course the claims of a woman to have been brutally raped by Muslim men, it turned out to be not true, and he's since been suspended. You're saying, what if there had been in that Sydney Morning Herald newsroom enough Muslims to say, hang on?
It takes enough people for you know, I think that idea of having enough people, so at least you open up the possibilities of at least one going, nah, hang on, guys. We can't possibly stand by this. There's something wrong with this.
Let me ask a final question to you, Stephanie. You know, we're talking about the need to go right through the production chain, from the face of a program to the executive producer to all the staff working on it, to make cultural change in an organisation, to ensure you have pools of people who think this can be a career path, all of which will deliver you a better product and a bigger audience. But the heart of real change is about significant numbers of probably mid-career white people moving aside. And that's painful, and perhaps they do feel defensive about it. Why wouldn't they? But isn't that the heart of it?
I don't think so. I think that every time I'm brought in to talk about this, there's a lot of fear coming from white people saying, oh my God, what about me? And I just don't understand that, because I don't see why there isn't space for all of us. Because I think there is space for all of us.
Well, there's a finite number of jobs, and we keep being told by our treasurers in Australia that we have to keep working till we're 70. And lots of middle-aged white men on their second, third and fourth marriages take this very seriously, Stephanie.
And they can keep going. They can certainly do that. And you know what? Instead, I guess us young people will just have to move to podcasts and younger organizations like BuzzFeed and Vox and completely overtake them. I mean, like, that's just the consequence. So you have two options here, right? You can make some room. You can listen to young people. You can listen to people of color. You can hire actually people of color who are editors, promote them, and so that you don't have, again, as Fatima says, like nightmares like this mistake with this.
The rape article, yeah.
Yes, this rape article. Or you can dig in, say, I deserve to be here and I should never move jobs or expand my horizons or think perhaps I could grow and change and maybe find work somewhere else or, you know, something else meaningful. But that's just death for an organization.
Well, Stephanie, here's an offer. I've got a bad cold. I'm not getting over it. I've had enough. This is your show. Take it. Don't fly home to America. You can have it. What do you reckon?
You know what? I, as honored as I am to be in this very large, glamorous studio, I think I'm really happy to work under Mr. Ira Glass.
Stephanie, thank you so much. Fatima, I should extend the same offer to you. Do you want my job?
Oh, sure. When can I start? Thank you so much for having me, Ellen.
Thank you. Fatima Meesham, columnist and consulting editor at Eureka Street, and Stephanie Fu, a producer at This American Life.